I wrote this, it's still kind of sketchy because that's half asleep when I wrote it. It's kind of a bit preachy. I meant to rewrite it, but I didn't quite get there. So I want you to. I want the straight lace to zigzag. The profound is what's real. I want the face on your name tag to be how you feel, because we love, because we live to learn to love, to learn to live, and we give to earn the gift we burn to give. We've got a life, we've got to give a gift, we've got to live. I want you to talk to the feeling of the evening on your skin and make it a friend before it ends, because if you do it right, she can introduce you to a knight. I want you to greet like she helped you beat the devil in a street fight and would do again. She's just waiting for the drop of the pin point at the sunset's tail to light a gin joint she'd rolled from her veil and filled with hot rocks that in spin anoint themselves the morning. I want you to move through like it just called by to say thank you.
Next we have Billy Ramsell.
Hey! This is a poem about a friend I had who was a painter, and he died. He was quite old, but it was still sad, like. When he was in hospital on his lap, like, when he was kind of on the way out, he did a few self-portraits in the hospital bed, you know, and in the middle of the night. But just what you call it, stuff, charcoal and ink and whatnot, you know, and paper like. You must know, sitting up in the lilac machine light, in the midnight silence of intensive care, as a machine does most of your breathing for you, and you sketch your own face over and over on half-inch thick New Somerset paper. £2 a sheet, you're crippled nurse, and when I'm finished, each page is worth nothing. You prick lead and smudge it into the fibres, in that medical silence interrupted by next door's coughing like brown paper crackling, a lilting giggle from the nurse's station, and the hushing rush of the CPAP machine, that winking, beeping desk beside your pillow, with its length of see-through tubing you think of as a coil, with its nozzle strapped over your half-willing mouth. It pushes air down through the branching trachea, diminishes the VQ mismatch, and holds the alveoli open that if closed will never expand again. It lets oxygen roam through the corridors, then through the tiny, tangled shafts of circulation, to your eyelids, your irises, your fingers splayed on the creamy sheet surface, to your clasping index and thumb that unclasp the 6B you've been clasping when you see not your own eyes which you just penciled in, but Icarus's careful eyes looking back at you. And you knuckle your forehead like the keyless at the moment when the door slams shut, as it comes to you not for the first time, but more suddenly, unutterably now in the hospital, that in painting your life for so long you've never quite witnessed it. You told me that. In the clock or the welcome in, I think it was, I remember a pewter-coloured Thursday in the guilty lull before rush hour, when beer's yeasty zest had loosened me enough to broach such things. You said, "It's all just ashes, Billy. All the pictures I made are just ashes. What do the images come to, all those tinctures and shapes, weighed next to the thousand sensations of walking from milk to the corner?" I relished the sense of acid and turpentine, the thick smell of paint, when I should have been out smelling lilacs or what have you. I spent year after year staring into that mirror, that subtle mirror, when I should have been looking out the window at the world. Those hazel, light-devouring eyes, from when you painted him over and over, Icarus puppet, Icarus resting, Icarus astray, till they cluttered your four-story studio, till you've made a race of watchers, looking out from diluted tangerine backgrounds, from their backgrounds of vermilion, their vast lopsided heads quizzical, indifferent, but their wings for the most part furled, shy of imposing their feathered hybridity. Till the day came when you fled from their gazes, down all the rickety stairs to Henrietta Street, a terrace of palaces in flaking red brick, then the accumulating February dusk stressed its shabby grandeur, its nobility and dereliction. And on the breeze there was a tang of rain, the breeze in undating that trench of moist and shadowy Georgiana, its freshets that carried you past the boarded up ground story flats, two fat barristers wobbling over the cobbles and the open side door of the King's Inn pub, the row of gleaming optics, the curdling sun-starved skin of a regular in the poker machine dimness, then through a blue papillonic billow of schoolgirls released from St. Carmel's, their skirts hitched up inches past regulation. The wind swirled their gossip, their washed electric scent after you. Hard-faced women sprinted for washing lines on the crumbling balconies of Dominic Street, as the spud smell drifting from their old, low and rain-rotten doorways was brought to muffle your nostrils on the aforementioned rain-forewarning wind. And as you stepped into Moore Street, you knew something had happened, for the fruit seller stood there open-mouthed, still speechless at the sight her sign, at the miracle they just minutes ago witnessed. And all the cheerful butchers of Moore Street, and all their apprentices, muttered and argued in their doorways, in huddled incredulity at what they'd seen. The boy with bird's wings they'd watched gobsmacked, unmoving to a man, their angled, gaping faces tracking the creature as he grew from point to miniature to full-sized figure afloat on wintry terminals, surfing gusts in an effortless arc of descent. And the fishwives, stalled in their banter still, stared at the spot where the bird boy had hovered above the mackerel on their beds of stinking ice, his fine boned face quizzical and passive as he took in the stalls of brassicas and plums, his bare and sinewy torso kept aloft by imperceptible wingbeats that turned to shushes when he corkscrewed suddenly upward, away over Henry Street, out toward the coastline, his wings declining to a V, then a moat, then nothing, a few seconds before he rounded the corner. Thank you.
I had goosebumps at one point, and then the hairs on my back stood up as well, so thanks, Billy. Next we have Paul Casey.
How many people are on the open mic there? I think this whole period of fortune and great riches that has plummeted into the darkness has been like a plaster on a very old wound, which it goes back 150 years, you know, or 160, 170 years. I'm the custodian of our family tree, and my great-great-grandfather was one of the first tenant farmers, Catholic tenant farmers, who got the rights to lease land during the famine. And I found a place up in Kilworth, up in a place called Crockyvaugh near Mitchelstown, where he had this very small farm holding. It's called Crockyvaugh Bog of Victories. You great-great-grandfather, emancipated tenant farmer, your eked out inheritance of resolve, your taproot of legacy deepening beneath the blazing gorse. You see as far north as time will tell. From your high well of clear water, nestled in the primary maneuver, lookouts knew nothing of these lines, this Waterford, Tipperary, Limerick, this Cork. How you've gained with tempered sinew through an ash-written era, your lithe retreat and backward sprint, a goalkeeper thrusts his command belts back blight into death-ridden days, forest and farm. Long ground in battle, shift in your steady eye, hold fast your breath. Here stood a great-great-grandson, young hope pollinating young fields, leased fields, thinned beasts close in the green. Now your home, a falling loft, whispers miracles to the fattened heifers of winter, rooted in this Kilworth mountain height, where knotmeal downs, dense galties, defends the final gateway to southern winds. A monster eagle rises from the dead. Its golden eye draws tight the quiet valleys and echo-restless mountains, recovers a palimpsest of land wars with wilderness. Soundless falls the blade of extinction.
Ed Ford. Shane Ford.
Hi, this is a translation from the second book of Homer's Iliad that describes the Greek army approaching Troy. Whenever a fearsome fire envelops a wood without end, perched on mountain ridges, the flame dazzle atop can be seen from afar below. Likewise, the glint of bronze marching out could be seen going skyward to the stars. Just as when hordes of birds, of geese, cranes, and long-necked swans, wheeling their way, winging, across the Asian marshland, over the Kyostrian River, revelling in the strength and sheen of their plumage, come to ground and make all the meadows resound with their honking, hissing, trumpeting. So the mass of gleaming bronze poured out from the ships and huts and spread over the Scamandrian plain, but the earth rang out with the clang of men's shoes and horse hooves. They stood arrayed on the Scamandrian meadows, embossed with flowers, as abundant as leaves and petals become in spring. In such a spring where clouds of flies roam through farmyards and teem over milk-soused pails. With those numbers, the Greeks faced the Trojans, relishing the prospect of raising Troy, eager to topple Ilium's great citadel. From flocks and herds innumerable raging far, each shepherd plucked his own with the ease that comes with age. As deftly did the Achaean leaders array their troops, steeling them for bloodshed. In their midst stood Agamemnon, with the eyes and head of Zeus above, who delights in flinging lightning, his thighs as thick as Ares, Poseidon's chest was his. Proudly a bull amongst cattle looms, the presence in the herd, a thing apart. Such mettle did Zeus bestow upon Agamemnon that day. Agamemnon, exalted by commoners, storied by heroes. Thank you.
Ooh. Patricia Welsh.
This is called Rules of Electrocution. May the electricity between these bodies sing to catch the union through the rainbow of a broken viewfinder into an image preserving your safety. Certainly it doesn't matter that I have no sense of society. Rather, an unfocused privilege, I feel the cadences of paralyzed status of life. Barred from broken emotion by yourself, electrocuted by the same aperture you once used to frame me, this is for your pleasure and yours alone.
Thanks, Patricia. Colm O. Quayla.
This poem is entitled Eva with an E. The city of the south, city of commerce, city of merchants. Names, new names, strange names, foreign names. People introducing themselves. Brown with an E. I'm not off here. My tongue has no memory of these sounds, of these words, but I will learn to speak these names. My daughter is off here, and she will know these names. She will know without knowing, and learn without learning. And in time, she too will introduce herself. Aoife. Aoife with an E.
Very good.
Thanks, Paul. Greece O'Donoghue.
This is called Shane Slade. And we lay, Slade, cross formation, no head to toe, no spoon or other intimate cutlery, but sticky, exhausted inhales. We peel apart, skin not wishing to separate, but it has set in, the shame. We were inevitably going to fail at hiding, burying the flames, the sparks that singed with every touch, the mini burst of colour with every look, the transitional need we placed for each other out of sight, out of mind. Absence caused loss of space and time. And when we caved, danced above the volcanic crater instead of trying to appease the flame, it felt like our skin would never be drenched of the caressing fire, cracking veins in the earth below us and colour bursting above us in the skies. But when the drunken energy of the fire ceremony had dissolved, the shame, the lack of eye contact, our eyes grey and colourless, the fire all but burnt out as we lie here, splayed. The single gold band on the third finger of your left hand reflects our faces, full of guilt, regret, and the shame, but also that little spark that still remains, our inner eyes freezing the frame, capturing the sticky sweet moment that we lie here displayed.
Thanks, Grace. Our last poet tonight is really going to test my reading and pronunciation skills. I think it's Kittery Connor.
The last time we were together, it was still summer. We watched the last cars shine out of the lot like stars, slowly moving across the sky, which was darker than the tar road from which we came. And when we knew that the park was closed and all the people were gone, we started sneaking up the mountain. Just a few kids after hours, trying to squeeze the last drop out of summer and the moon and the stars. We reached the top, breathless and astounded. The mountain was bathed in a white, milky glow, pouring out of the stars, which were nothing like cars. Thirsty, I opened my mouth like a jar, aching to drink in pure light. You pointed out the landmarks below and the rush of the cars, which looked nothing like stars, but it seemed silly to come to the mountain to look at the city when we'd left the city to come see the mountain. Our eyes bright, our step light, the three of us went to find the true Lee Echo. We leaned on the trunk with rapt attention, and we listened, and we spoke, and we heard the heart of granite speak our dreams back to us, as if returning things we'd forgotten, until there were so many things, so many words that they got caught in knots in the back of our throats, and we huddled close to the close of summer, like beggars, desperately trying to scrap the facts and hold on to the crumbs that summer would leave us. And when the words could no longer come and our hearts could no longer whisper, they came instead, showering down our sun-dried cheeks, rivers of fire scathing our skin, digging furrows like foxes. We could feel ourselves shiver in our short-sleeved shirts, though it must have been 60 degrees at least. As we fused our trembling limbs, we thought of our high school friends, scattered like comets, Atlanta, Paris, Philadelphia, Khartoum, Manchester, Manila. Our bright cluster had burst, dispersed in space, and we just stood there, 20 years old and afraid of letting go, soundlessly dusting stars out of our eyes, anything not to break the silence, scared that if we moved, we would break.
Thank you. Breaking news, we have one more poet. Carl's going to come and do a poem for us, I think. Is he?
Yeah.
Well, I think he's still writing it as we speak, so he may be a minute or two. No, here he comes.
The 21st century Marx, and by Marx I mean the philosopher of economics, not like... Ooh, I cut myself. Yeah. 21st century Marx. I love the means of production so much that when I sweep our masters out of office after the revolution, I will keep it all for myself. And such is my love for my proletarian comrades that after a time, after the dust has settled, as it were, I shall repackage it and sell it back to them at a low, low price. Okay.